Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we go inside the search for the next superintendent of one of the state's largest school districts and talk to Fresno Unified Board Chair Brooke Ashton. We'll talk about the effort to replace Michael Hansen and the status of the FBI investigation into the district's operations. We'll also learn why going east to west in Kern County might finally be getting easier soon as construction on the Centennial Corridor Freeway in Bakersfield is approaching. We'll talk to City Councilmember Andre Gonzalez about what the city is doing to move the project along. Plus, a look back at the 75th anniversary of a dark moment in American and Valley history, the executive order that sent Japanese Americans to internment camps during World War II. Judge Dale Ikeda will join us. We begin today's show, though, at the northern end of the Central Valley at Lake Oroville on the Feather River. It was a week ago that the main spillway on the state's second largest reservoir began to erode away under the pressure of massive flood releases. Oroville, which is the tallest dam in the nation, is one of the main facilities of the state water project that sends water to Kern County and much of Southern California. With a compromised main spillway and levels in the reservoir rising, on Saturday, water began to spill over the concrete weir of the dam's emergency spillway onto a bare hillside, causing more erosion. On Sunday evening, it got so bad that officials ordered an emergency evacuation of 180,000 people downstream, with a warning that the emergency spillway could fail within an hour. That could have sent a 30-foot wall of water into the valley below. Officials doubled releases on the main spillway to try to bring the lake level down, and they were successful. Here's Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey talking yesterday about the difficult decisions officials faced.
Public safety professionals did their job to protect the public, and we were able to get people evacuated out of the community in a fairly timely fashion and for such a chaotic event in a fairly orderly manner. And at the same time, our partners at the Department of Water Resources were working to save that structure and prevent further damage so that we could go on. That's a double success. Now, as I said earlier, getting those people home is important to me. I want that to happen as absolutely soon as possible. But I have to be able to sleep at night knowing that they're back into that area. And if it's raining and there's more water coming in the lake, if I can't in good conscience believe that those people are safe, I haven't done my job. And so that's what I'm going to do.
And one of the big questions today remains, when will those people go home? Officials stress the dam itself is not in danger at this time, and the plan to lower the level of the reservoir is working. But while a massive disaster was averted, the crisis may just be beginning, with more storms on the way and a massive snowpack in the Sierra. Joining us now to bring us up to date on the situation at Oroville and surrounding communities is Steve Milne at our sister station, Capital Public Radio. Steve, welcome.
Hi, Joe.
Steve, let's first talk about these evacuations still underway. What do we know right now about when people might be able to go home?
That's the thing, Joe. We don't know yet because, you know, the state is really working hard to try to fix the spillway. As you know, as kind of explained earlier, last week there were chunks of concrete coming out of the spillway when the State Department of Water Resources was releasing water from Oroville Dam. So, you know, and the state wants to make sure that they have things in place before they let people go back home. And as you mentioned, another storm is coming up. So, I mean, the residents are in limbo right now. They're staying in county fairgrounds where evacuations have been set up throughout that region.
Now, there's also a drama playing out on the state and national level with regards to this emergency declaration. Governor Brown held a press conference last night. There's been, to say the least, tensions between the Brown administration and the state government and the Trump administration in Washington. What do we know right now about how things are working in the effort to try to get some cooperation with federal authorities?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, the governor says he has spoken with one of Trump's recently confirmed cabinet members, though he wouldn't say exactly which member that was. But, you know, even though we've heard the president say that California has, that he would actually withhold aid from California, he said that earlier this month, the governor says he believes Washington and California will work together in a constructive way.
That's my attitude. There will be different points of view, but we're all one America, and we all have challenges that we share in common. And as we defend America, we defend California and vice versa.
So the governor is pretty optimistic, and the governor also says that many aspects of the dam's infrastructure will get scrutinized in the days to come.
There's been a lot of talk about that, as well as a lot of media reports have highlighted some documents from 2005 where environmental groups raised concerns about just this sort of accident happening, or incident, I should say, happening at the dam. Is that something the governor has addressed? Have state officials come out in any way talking about what they knew about the potential risks with the spillway?
Well, the governor says he's glad he found out about the report and adds that it was not part of previous records he had seen. So it sounds like, no, he wasn't aware of it. But, yeah, I mean, this is, more than a decade ago, around 2005, a motion filed with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission shows that three environmental groups or advocacy groups said that using the emergency spillway at the Orville Dam would cause significant erosion. The groups warned of a failure of the dam itself that would threaten lives and property. But state officials said in 2008, no significant concerns about the spillway's integrity had been raised in any government or independent review. So kind of a conflicting, you know, we're hearing conflicting things there.
I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more about that as the story comes out about what exactly happened and investigations into the cause of the main failure progress. I understand there's already some federal assistance flowing into the Orville area dealing with FEMA and the immediate response. What's happening there?
Yeah, about 100 federal responders are helping with the emergency. Federal Emergency Management Agency regional head Asha Tribble says FEMA and the U.S. Departments of Transportation, Defense, and Health have staff on site. Tribble says they're mostly advising state officials and preparing contingencies, but FEMA has also provided material support.
We are already moving commodities, and commodities being cots, blankets, and water, given the number of people that were actually evacuated.
Of course, the president will still have to decide whether to release further aid, and we still are awaiting, to get that word.
Now, 180,000 people, at least that's the number that's been publicly released in this evacuation area. Where did people go? What are they doing right now? They were told to leave their homes within an hour due to this potential imminent collapse on Sunday night. Thankfully, that collapse did not happen, but they're still out of their homes. What's happening there?
Yeah, it was a pretty incredible scene, too, Joe, on Sunday night. You know, televised news reports showed just a long line of cars heading out of town, heading out of Orville. And, you know, you can just imagine how those residents were feeling. One of those people, Roy Bowling, he lives in Orville. He's staying at the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds in Chico. That's just one of several evacuation centers that have been set up in various fairgrounds throughout the region. And at Chico, he's one of 1,000 evacuees staying at this fairgrounds.
I had to go over here to Chico VA this morning because I'm a disabled vet. I had to go over here to get my medication that I couldn't go back and get.
So, yeah, these people are dealing with, you know, they didn't have time to even take their medication with them when they kind of had to get out of town. Gary Cantwell is with the Red Cross. He says the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds is offering cots and blankets, water and food and other supplies like diapers. And Cantwell says there's been an outstanding response from the Butte County and Chico communities.
We are having businesses coming in all the time saying, what do you want? What do you need? We'll give it.
So So, you know, people are helping other people, but, I mean, yeah, it's still a situation where these folks don't know when they can go home.
So immediate disaster averted on Sunday night by the additional releases from the already damaged main spillway of the reservoir. Yesterday, William Croyle, the acting head of the Department of Water Resources, said they want to lower the level of Lake Oroville down by about 50 feet to make room for additional flood flows coming in from snowmelt and future storms. As of this morning at about 8 o'clock, the level had dropped around 12 feet from its peak. This idea that there might be more water flowing in, more than an idea, I guess, there's another storm on the way, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could come as late as Wednesday night and, you know, early Thursday morning, more rain. But, you know, the National Weather Service is saying a lot of rain, but not as much as this region got last week around this time when, you know, there's widespread, you know, like small creeks flooding and street flooding and other like rural places where in low-lying areas where there was flooding. But so they're saying not as much rain as last week. But, yeah, as you said, the reservoir, you know, engineers are trying to lower the reservoir surface level by 50 feet in the coming days. But the Department of Water Resources says, you know, doing that, lowering that by that much could take up to 2 weeks or longer. And, of course, this all depends on future weather conditions. So Republican Congressman Doug LaMalfa's district includes a large portion of the affected area. He says the immediate goal is to get through this crisis without any loss of life or undue harm.
But also to immediately, when this is over with, to move forward and restore the function of the spillway and the dam, because we'll have till next November to have something that works, depending on what next year's rainfall is going to be.
So, you know, even when this is all over, there's next winter to think about. So it's,
things are moving very quickly, and more storms and snowmelt on the way. Steve, before we go, this idea of trying to fix the situation, to fix that hole that was developing in the emergency spillway, we saw some TV images of helicopters and boulders. What's going on with that effort?
Yeah, they're using these big helicopters that can handle, I think it's like 2-ton bags of boulders, and they're dropping these bags into the spillway area, the emergency spillway that kind of gave way on Saturday. Well, let's see, I think it was Sunday. So they're still doing it. They were doing it this morning. I mean, it's going to take a couple of days to do that. So it's still going on, and that's why people can't go home yet. I mean, the work is still ongoing, and another storm is on the way.
And there will be a lot more work after that to get Lake Oroville and the dam and spillways back into their original state. Again, joining us today, Steve Milne from our sister station, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, talking about the situation at Oroville Dam today. Steve, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For the first time in a decade, one of the largest school districts in the state, Fresno Unified, is searching for a new superintendent. After lengthy closed session negotiations last month, the district and former superintendent Michael Hansen parted ways February 1st, months ahead of the original plan, which had Hansen leaving in August. One of Hansen's most persistent critics was school board president Brooke Ashton, who joins us now on the phone. Brooke, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me.
What's the working relationship like now between the board and the administration? How has that changed since Michael Hansen left?
I listened to your intro and it said that his persistent critic or most popular critic or whatever it was. But, you know, it really wasn't a criticism on a person. It was a criticism on results. And so now that I've seen a huge change in staff and a blossoming of people that want to just, you know, serve kids. And it's been a unique opportunity to be here at this time to see where Fresno Unified is going. And I think it's just going to great places.
What are you looking for in a new superintendent?
Well, I think, we're going to need, first of all, the superintendent is a term that's shared very loosely. So really what we need is a CEO of $1 billion organization. And that CEO is going to need to take care of teachers. It's going to need to take care of parents, and it's going to take most importantly take care of students. And so we're looking for somebody that is has a 360 degree view of the entire picture, but also has, you know, his eye on the sparrow, that one child, and it's going to spend some time in the classrooms and figure out how to take us from, you know, Mike Hansen took us from bad to better, and I want to go from better to great. And that's the guy, that's the man or woman that we're looking for to be able to take us there.
How important it is just being able to communicate with the public? It seems like Michael Hansen, while he did greatly improve the district's finances and a lot of other endeavors behind the scenes, out there in the media and communicating with whether it's teachers or the public may not have been his strong suit. Do you see that as an important thing you're looking for?
You know, I think that that the public, and myself included, have seen this greater and greater in the last 3 years. And you know where we've seen this, Joe? I'll tell you, in a man named Joe Castro. That guy came into Fresno State, and he is the people's champion. He on Twitter, he'll fix a light bulb in a dorm room. I mean, he's got time for the janitor, and yet he's meeting with the UC chancellors across the state and governors of the great state of California. That's the guy we're looking for. I mean, that the communication part and the empathy and being able to understand children and in all walks of life that they come from, the richest of the rich to the poorest of the poor. We need somebody that understands the plight of the Fresno Unified child, and that's going to be hard to find, but they're there. They're there.
Do you see the district going in a different direction in a significant way with the new superintendent? You know, one of Hansen's big projects was this participation in this core group of major urban districts throughout the state. They got a waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act from the federal government. Is Fresno going to still pursue those same sorts of things?
You know, the new superintendent, we certainly don't want to put him. We don't want to put that person in a box and say, here's where you're going to go or here's where you're not going to go. We're looking for someone to come in and lead our district under the direction, you know, to work with seven trustees, which at times can be difficult at best. But I think that to say we're going to go with CORE or not with CORE, I can tell you where the board is leaning. The board is leaning into more career technical education. We're in talks with people all over the city of how to do this and how to do it more efficiently. We're looking for more bilingual education, what we refer to as dual immersion. I'm pushing really hard from that. You're going to see two announcements that are going to come out of Fresno Unified, particularly Bullard High School, in the next 30 to 45 days that are going to blow your mind. There's some stuff that we've been working on a long time that's going to be incredible. And I'm hoping that in conjunction, one of those will be in conjunction, hopefully, with Sunnyside High, that's the direction we want to go. You're going to start to see the curtains lifted off Fresno Unified in such a way that people are going to be envious of this district, and they're going to want to send their kids here. They're not going to be flighting to go to Clovis. They're going to be flighting Clovis to try to fight to get into Fresno Unified.
There's been a lot of talk recently about the district's approach to school discipline, which recently moved to adopt principles of restorative justice, which essentially is an alternative to suspending and expelling students in many cases who act out. While those numbers have dropped significantly of suspensions and expulsions, you have teachers who are being assaulted by students in the classroom. We saw recently in McLean, many teachers in the district have said they have big concerns with the district's discipline practices. What do you think about the way the district has been dealing with school discipline? How would you like to see that change?
You know, we are not, restorative justice works, but we're not applying it properly. So with the help of Lisa Smitkamp, our DA, has offered to help along with Jerry Dyer. They have a program that works, and we should be working in conjunction with them to make this program work, the restorative justice. But restorative justice, Joe, as you know, is not the end-all be-all. There still has to be suspensions. And some of the kids that are bad actors need a little bit tougher of approach than some of the others. But there's also things out there, the peer-to-peer mentoring. You know, I think that we're not efficient in doing that and helping some of these kids, putting our arm around some of these kids and bringing them along with us. So those are ways we can improve. But teacher safety and child safety and discipline should be our number one task right now, right here, this moment, because it's important and it's out of control. We've got to somehow, maybe a touchy phrase, but no more can the inmates run the asylum. That can't happen no more. We've got to go back to where the teacher, the principal, you know, at Bullard High School, we've got a Principal Castillo there that doesn't happen there. I mean, we have control. And so it can be done. It can be done certainly more effectively and more efficiently, but we're going to get control of the classroom to where kids are going to learn again.
You told Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee last week that contrary to what Superintendent Hansen had told the media shortly before he left the job, that the FBI investigation into the district's school construction practices and contracts is not only still underway, it's, quote, going full blast. What did you mean by that? Have you had, you or other district staff, had contact with the FBI or DOJ this year?
No, but they haven't stopped. And so to say that they have stopped is just not accurate. They're looking at everything. They've got a million pieces of paper, whatever they're looking at. You know, and certainly I'm not revealing to you anything outside of board communications or outside of giving you inside baseball from closed session items. You know, I have my own attorney that deals with these guys, and they're looking at it. And it's not stopping. I mean, they haven't come out with a decision yet. And so, but you know, we need to look past that mark. That was a bad mark in Fresno Unified's history. And we've got to look past that. And we've got to be able to say, let them do what they're going to do. But in the meanwhile, we got to educate children. We've got to move this mark and move it in a big, big way. Because it's not moving in a big way. These graduation rates that we talk about, the 82, the 83, the 85%. Well, anybody can graduate if there's no California high school exit exam. You know, but can they read and write and do arithmetic? And we've got to go back to getting some sort of an analysis of how that's going to work and what that's going to look like. And are we having kids that are ready for college-ready kids or career-ready kids? That's the two focuses that I see as one board member of seven where we've got to go to.
What's morale like in the district right now?
I personally think morale is the highest I've ever seen it. Places where I go say, hey, what, you know, I've been holding back on this idea. What do you think about this? Or what if I was to bring this forward? Or what if we tried that? I think morale is very, very high. I think that staff's morale is high. You know, anytime you've got change, there's a little bit of questioning of who's going to go and who's going to stay. We're not looking to get rid of anybody. That's not what this is about. This is about, you know, I think the best way to explain it is every 4 to 8 years, we change the most powerful person in the world. It's called the President of the United States. And we seem to keep going on. President Unified is going to go on, and we're going to go on, and we're going to find somebody that's going to take us from better to best. And I think that you're going to see that looking forward. And the public approach, the approach to it is going to be extremely public. The public is going to have, we're going to go out and ask them, well, what are you looking for? What do you want to see? What haven't we done well and what can we do better? And I think you'll see a lot of public participation. I think that people are going to be very, very pleased on how the process takes shape and takes hold. And I think in the meanwhile, you're going to see Fresno Unified's pedal to the metal. We're not going to slow down and wait. We are going to move this needle in a big, big way.
What's the timeline like for hiring a new superintendent, doing a search? Is this a national search? How does it work?
You know, we'll hire a company that will give us a national search. That doesn't mean we're not going to look local as well. We'll be looking locally. We'll be looking throughout the state, and we're going to be looking nationally to see, you know, who we can get for this position. So I think that the process needs to start immediately, only because superintendent's contracts run July 1 through June 30th. So in order for to get somebody in that position, we need to be having those conversations now. So we need to start that search process immediately.
Brooke Ashton is the board president at the Fresno Unified School District Board of Trustees. He joins us today on Valley Public Radio talking about the district's quest to replace now a departed superintendent, Michael Hansen. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Joe. Anytime.
This is Valley Edition. Much of the focus on the potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act has been on the newly insured people that stand to lose their coverage. But there could be consequences that reach far beyond just people's health care and impact nearly every taxpayer in the Central Valley. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports repealing the law without a replacement has some county lawmakers and officials worried.
Republicans in Washington, D.C. are busy figuring out their way forward on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. Much of the reporting focus has been on what will happen to the thousands of Valley residents who found new insurance coverage, either through Covered California or, more importantly, Medi-Cal expansion. However, behind the scenes, a big transformation has been underway at local hospitals and county governments as they adjust to the new health insurance reality, saving millions on the local level. With the potential for that to change, local leaders are taking a closer look at the fiscal impact repeal could have on their budgets.
Well, I'm trying not to hit the panic button, but it's hard not to when you think about the impact fiscally to the county's bottom line.
That's Kern County Supervisor Leticia Perez. Her district is home to Kern Medical, which is run by the Kern County Hospital Authority. For years, the hospital is losing tens of million dollars a year, draining county resources away from other services. However, after the ACA's coverage expansion, which slashed the uninsurance rate dramatically, and with some structural changes to how the hospital operates, it's now back in the black. Perez fears that repeal could deeply upset the current financial picture, costing the county as much as $50 million a year to keep its doors open.
But it is shocking because of what we have been through and trying to survive and save this hospital. The idea that a new administration, for whatever reason, could change all that overnight is absolutely terrifying.
Repealing without replacement is doubly scary to Perez because the county's been hammered by poor tax receipts due to the downturn in oil prices, and she says they just don't have the cash. Kern Medical declined to comment for this story. Other counties could face hard budget choices, too. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, state courts ruled that counties must be the provider of last resorts for their poorest residents. Unlike Kern County, Fresno did not run its own hospital. However, they had an arrangement with Community Regional Medical Center to provide care for roughly 19,000 residents through a program called the Medically Indigent Services Program, or MISP. That contract was for about $20 million a year. Fresno County Public Health Director Dave Palmaville says under the ACA, the county was permitted to roll those people into the Medi-Cal expansion, removing that expense from the county budget sheets.
Part of that is that includes primary care, preventative care, as well as hospitalization, emergency room visits, and so forth. So it's much more manageable, and it's a much more proactive and preventative approach.
However, if the ACA is repealed, the mandate counties provide this care will remain. So counties would again have to pick up the cost. Palmaville says that old $20 million a year contract with community is gone, and it's unlikely the price would be as low the second time around.
In fact, in 2013, we did some studies to analyze what the actual cost of service, what those costs would be if we had to go provide services outside of that contract. And we expect that those costs would have been $85 to $90 million.
A year, annually.
It's not just the cost that would hit the county. Palmaville says millions of dollars in state support that had flown to the county for MISP have ended or been redirected, meaning the county would be hit with a fiscal double whammy. It would be very difficult for hospitals and counties to simply flip the switch and go back to 2009. Jan Emerson Shea with the California Hospital Association says that is because over the years, hospitals have fundamentally altered their financial models to adjust for more people having insurance and having less uncompensated care on their books.
One of the big components for us is hospitals, and particularly, obviously, if you're a bigger hospital, you took a larger cut. Hospitals took a significant cut in payments as a way to help pay for the expanded coverage that came with the ACA.
Emerson Shea says the hospitals would want to see that funding restored if the law is repealed. That might be a tough sell to a Republican Congress and president. However, she's also quick to point out that there's no clear replacement plan on the table, making this kind of prediction game difficult, especially with the remarkable and unexpected speed of change in Washington. However, President Donald Trump was quoted in the press saying a fully formed replacement plan could take as much as a year to prepare. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For years, going from east to west in Bakersfield has been a major ordeal. The 58 freeway, for decades, has hit a dead end where it meets Highway 99, and travelers on the highway have been forced to take the surface streets of Rosedale Highway to continue traveling on State Route 58. That soon could change, though, as the Centennial Corridor Freeway Project aims to connect 58 from Highway 99 to the new Westside Parkway Freeway, which already exists north of the Kern River. But there are challenges. The neighborhood of West Park lies in the way, with dozens of homes either in the path of the freeway or adjacent to the planned structure. Those homes are in Ward 2, which is represented by new City Council member Andre Gonzalez, who joins us now on Valley Public Radio. Andre, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
So Caltrans approved this route back in 2012. What's the current status of this decades-long quest to build this freeway?
Well, currently demolition work is underway. It has been since midsummer. Acquisition of several properties have continued. 189 out of 192 single-family residences have been acquired. 9 out of 9 multifamily residences have been acquired, and 14 out of 18 commercial properties are now owned by the city. As I mentioned, demolition work is continuing and progressing. We're about 90% of the way there in terms of demolition.
So you've been meeting with constituents over the last few weeks. What are the topics that people are discussing right now?
Well, you know, Joe, it was really clear to me when I was running for city council and knocking on doors throughout the neighborhood of West Park that many people had been opposed to the project for years, but were now resigned to the fact that this project is happening. Demolition had begun, and reality had set in that this was the new norm for the neighborhood of West Park. And so they had still many questions about what the Centennial Corridor would look like going through West Park, whether or not they'd have access to the neighborhood park, Centennial Park, which is a beautiful community asset for the neighborhood. Whether or not they would have a cul-de-sac, or what they could expect in terms of sound walls in their neighborhood. And so the city and Caltrans had a series of 3 meetings over the last 2 weeks to really address a lot of those concerns and spend a lot of time with residents one-on-one so that they could ask directly to the engineers who designed this corridor what they can expect when this whole project is completed. And it was really productive.
Now, for a long time, Caltrans has been criticized throughout the state for building freeways that divide neighborhoods and not to mention that create other problems, obvious things like sound and just having a big piece of infrastructure there, the pollution that comes from having all those cars. Obviously, there's some limits to what Caltrans can do to mitigate that, but what are some of the steps that are being taken? You mentioned cul-de-sacs and things like that. Is Caltrans taking some measures to try to make this more livable for those residents that are still there?
Yeah, absolutely. Mitigation steps have been taken. In the design, there will be an overcrossing structure at Morella Way and also at La Mirada Drive, which are two main neighborhood streets. So that there is a path for neighborhood residents that's convenient and quick for them to enter and exit their neighborhood. In addition to that, there will be a Class 1 multi-use path to shorten the walking distance across the freeway and connect existing bike lanes within the area. And we're very proud of our bike lanes and our bike path in this area. And so this will only enhance the area and provide that amenity for residents. So I think a lot of people are really looking forward to those amenities.
So right now, 58 essentially dead ends with Highway 99, or used to dead end at the old Wild West Shopping Center. That's now gone. But is this going to be an elevated structure? Is it going to be dug into the earth? What would residents see in the future if they were going through the what is now West Park neighborhood?
So you're right that 58 is dead end on railroad for decades. And so at that point, it will fly over Stockdale Highway. And then as it enters West Park, it will actually be a depressed freeway. So it will be underground. As it moves further to the northwest, as it gets to California Avenue, it then ascends and goes over Truxton and the Kern River.
Now, the city has already started buying and demolishing homes in this area, as you mentioned. There's also sometimes when these projects happen, concerns that property is purchased and then it falls victim to vandalism or people who break in, squatters and things like that. Is that a concern? And what is the city doing that? Because the city's directly involved in purchasing this property.
Yeah, it's certainly we've heard those concerns from residents about squatters and several incidents of vandalism of homes that currently are occupied in the neighborhood. And that's a huge concern. And we've, at the series of community meetings, we've had the Bakersfield Police Department on hand to speak with residents about specific concerns. The best way to mitigate that problem is to move ahead with demolition work. And so the city has been very quick to demolish homes that they need and to really clean the area and keep it clear so that we can prevent a lot of those incidents.
Now, last October, there was a ruling in the state appeals court that was in regards to a lawsuit brought by some homeowners in the area saying the city can't use state gas tax funds to help pay off that project. What's the status of that lawsuit? Is there a resolution or is that still out there hanging around in the courts?
No, the city did prevail in two of the three funding mechanisms locally. So city can use transportation impact fees and utility surcharge fees to fund the project. And, you know, the city financing plan is sound. We've also been able to obtain grants that have significantly reduced the original borrowing amount. City once estimated the need to borrow $270 million for the project. That estimate has been revised to $135 million.
Talking with Andre Gonzalez of the Bakersfield City Council today about the Centennial Corridor project. Nationally, there's a lot of discussion about freeways, especially in larger cities. And in many cases, there's a theory out there that, that building more freeways doesn't necessarily lead to less traffic. And the story goes, or the theory goes, that that's because building more freeways actually encourages more people to drive or more people to take advantage of the lanes that are out there. Do you think that's an issue? And how do you think this is actually going to play out in terms of making it easier to get across town? Are we going to see less gridlock, less traffic, or is it just inevitable that those lanes are going to be filled up quickly?
Well, I think that this should have been done, quite frankly, 40 years ago. And I think that we're trying to catch up to the growth and the demand and the needs for our local community and for the region that have existed for years. And further, this Centennial Corridor will have actually national implications because it is an east-west corridor for the state. 58 connects to I-40. So this will be a route that, that many will take from the east coast to I-5. So it has a significant benefit for our region and for our nation to complete this this corridor. So I believe that we're trying to play catch up in this case.
Before we go, the timeline moving forward, when does construction on the freeway itself actually begin, and when could residents hope to drive on this new freeway?
Initial work will begin late spring for the Kern River bridges, which is the first phase of this project. as we progress forward, we'll begin the building sound walls, working on sewers, relining gas, electrical, and cable TV facilities. There will also be sound wall construction that will take place in late spring. The final project is set to be completed in mid-2021, early 2022.
We'll look forward to that big opening. I'm sure it will be a grand affair. City Council Member Andre Gonzalez, one of the newest members of the council, joining us today representing Ward 2, which is home to the Centennial Corridor Freeway Project, about to get underway in a few months in the city of Bakersfield. Andre, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which forcibly removed Japanese American citizens from their homes and farms on the West Coast and placed them in internment camps for years. Many of the families that were rounded up and sent to the camps came from the San Joaquin Valley. Over four decades later, President Ronald Reagan described it like this.
We gather here today to right a grave wrong. More than 40 years ago, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, 120,000 persons of Japanese ancestry living in the United States were forcibly removed from their homes and placed in makeshift internment camps. This action was taken without trial, without jury. It was based solely on race, for these 120,000 were Americans of Japanese descent. Yes, the nation was then at war, struggling for its survival, and it's not for us today to pass judgment upon those who may have made mistakes while engaged in that great struggle. Yet we must recognize that the internment of Japanese Americans was just that, a mistake. For throughout the war, Japanese Americans in the tens of thousands remained utterly loyal to the United States.
Now the local Japanese community is marking the 75th anniversary of the order with ceremonies and a new exhibit at Fresno State. Joining us to tell us more is Fresno County Superior Court Judge Dale Ikeda, who is a member of the Japanese American Citizens League Central California District Council. Judge Ikeda, welcome.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for having me on your program.
I want to start out, before we talk about the national significance, before we talk about the events, your family has a story that dates to this time period as well. Tell me about what happened to your family during that time in the internment.
Well, I might not be here, but for the internment, my father grew up in Clovis. My mother was in West Fresno. And one of the consequences of the executive order was a travel restriction and curfew. So my dad had to have a Caucasian friend take him to West Fresno so he could see my mom. And then when the internment order came out for Fresno Japanese Americans to report to the Fresno Fairgrounds, my parents were married, and my dad decided that to keep the families together, they would report together to the Fresno Assembly Center, where they were interned for several months before going to a more permanent camp, the Jerome War Relocation Center in Arkansas.
Now we have a lot of newer residents in the San Joaquin Valley who maybe aren't familiar with the history, and also younger listeners as well. The Fresno Center was also matched by a center in Pinedale. Tell me a little more about what happened here locally and where local people went. How did it work?
The folks who were interned at the Pinedale Assembly Center actually came from Washington, Oregon, and Sacramento County. There were over 4,800 folks interned there. You can imagine coming from mild or cool climates and arriving in Pinedale. The camp there was open from May through July 1942. And I had an uncle, Jack Hata, describe that as arriving in hell. It was so hot. And his train trip was on his birthday, actually.
What was the reaction like, both in the Japanese-American community and the U.S. public at large in 1942 when President Roosevelt issued this order? Did civil liberties groups raise concerns at that time? What was the immediate response? This is obviously a little over 2 months after Pearl Harbor. What was the response at that time?
Well, the immediate response was one of apprehension. It was not only a blow to America, injecting America formally into World War II, but now Japanese Americans, 70% born here in the United States, were fearful as to the consequences. The Fresno Bee had an interesting story about my aunt who was going to Clovis High School. She was a senior, and she got on the school bus not knowing what to expect from her fellow students. And Frank Mesplay, the student body president, sat next to her, put his hand on hers, and reassured her. And there were a lot of communities that were very supportive of the Japanese-American community, including Clovis Unified School District and the mayor and others who came out in support of Japanese-Americans in a letter saying, we're sorry this is happening, but when it's over, we hope you will return. Of course, the sad side of this story is that there was really mass hysteria, misinformation about possible espionage and sabotage. And the executive order says that military commanders could issue orders to exclude any and all persons from certain military zones. General John L. DeWitt, who was the commander of the Western Defense Command, used that as the basis to not only exclude Japanese Americans entirely from the West Coast, but also intern them for several years in the desolate areas inland.
And at the same time as this is happening, you have Japanese Americans who are volunteering for the armed forces and serving with great valor.
Well, that's true, although that was a little later in the story. My uncle, for example, was already in the Army at the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and he remained in the Army. His commander said he should be treated the same as any other soldiers. Some others were not as fortunate. They were confined to barracks under guard when President Roosevelt was in the area. Shortly after the attack on Pearl Harbor, all military-aged Japanese Americans were reclassified 4C. Enemy alien, ineligible for the draft. It was only later that there was a small group created the 100th Battalion out of Hawaii, and that group fought with distinction in Italy, and then as you know, in Hawaii, there were not a mass roundup, although there were a few isolated internment centers. Later, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team was created, as well as the Military Intelligence Service, and the 442 fought in Europe. The Military Intelligence Service officers served as interpreters in the Pacific in separate units.
And became one of the most decorated, if not the most decorated, unit in the armed forces.
It's often cited as the most decorated unit in American military history for its size and length of service.
Turning to the present day, how do you think this bit of America's history, a dark chapter in American history, informs the present conversation?
Well, the Japanese American Citizens League is the oldest and largest civil rights organization in America. And the day after the terrorist attack on September 11, 2001, the very next day, the JACL issued a press release that we should not take this chapter out on the Arab and Muslim Americans and not repeat the mistakes of the past. So JACL has for a long time, along with other groups, tried to educate the public. That was one of the main reasons of its support for the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which resulted in a presidential apology and token monetary payments for those who were interned. And that goes back to that segment you were referring to. More recently, there have been issues raised about immigration and whether we should embrace our immigrants and embrace our history as a nation of immigrants, and JCL and other groups have come out in support of immigrant groups. I understand that the last year we had 6 Nobel laureates. They were all immigrants. And I heard a figure that recently over half of the engineers that we have are coming from other countries. So immigrant populations and their diversity is a strength.
Before we go, an exhibit at Fresno State marks the 75th anniversary. It's at the Henry Madden Library. Tell me about that and what's opening up later this month to mark the occasion.
Fresno State is sponsoring this program through Madden Library. JCL has been proud to be a supporter and co-sponsor of some of the activities there. Starting next week, there will be an exhibit on the second floor of the Madden Library, open to the public, no cost, and there'll be 2 traveling exhibits as well as local artifacts and stories. So I encourage folks to go to the Ellipse, the gallery on the second floor, and view that. I think it'll be very interesting.
It's very much a story that relates to the present day and very much a local story as well, as so many of those families came from the Valley and so many of them are still here today. Again, Fresno County Superior Court Judge Dale Ikeda, a member of the Japanese American Citizens League Central California District Council, thank you so much for joining us today, Your Honor.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, I'd like to encourage you to send us your comments. Let us know what you think at talk@kvpr.org and on Twitter @Valley Edition and @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.